Well, if you're ready to go, we'll rip into it and then we can have a chat, because I'm very excited about having you on. So thanks for joining us, man. It's I'm a bit of an American political junkie.
As am I.
Yeah. So when I heard about your documentary series, now it is three parts, isn't it? A three-part documentary series. Okay.
Yeah.
Unprecedented, and here in New Zealand, people can see it free to air. I'll bring it up on the screen so people can see on TV3. It's being played online, 3 on demand. So if people want to go check it out in New Zealand, they can. 3 on demand. But I know it's everywhere and it's all over the world. And I actually played a little clip of it, that like from YouTube, the actual preview of it, the trailer of it, the other night when I was talking about it. And I got demonetized. So I won't play any footage because I'll get demonetized again. And then I'll have to go, no, but I'm talking to the actual guy who made it. So I'm allowed to. So I won't. People can go check it out. It is amazing. I consumed it so very quickly. They're about an hour each, so 3 hours. What was the reason for doing it as a sort of three part rather than a one, you know, like a 2.5 hour doco or something? Was it just a time constraint thing?
No, and I think that there was, well, I mean, originally it was it was thought to be a feature, but then we decided after sort of certain things happening that it made sense for us to sort of split them up, because each one is sort of somewhat self-contained, but they also do all sort of follow on a narrative. I mean, you can watch all three together and you can sort of split them up as well. So.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm assuming some of those things that happened, you were talking about, are things like, I don't know, January 6th, because I was watching that part of, I think that comes up pretty much in episode 3. And I was thinking, shit, this could be like a 90 minute doco all by itself, just the information in here and the flow on from it up to and including you before the select committee, which must've been terrifying.
It was definitely an experience, for sure.
on that, I've looked around for footage of it. There doesn't seem to be any footage of you testifying. It was all in private. Was there a reason for that?
Yes, so the way it normally works, I think it works with this particular committee, is that everybody is interviewed, what they call a transcribed interview. So it's sort of under oath, essentially, and it's done in a private room, and you've got the lawyers for the committee, as well as a screen of all the committee members that come in on sort of video link. And so that's what I did. So I went through a 2-hour interview process with them, talking about the material we had captured.
Wow. And do you know of anything from that interview, that conversation, then got, I'm like, it almost sounds like, not to be dismissive, but that sounds like the minor leagues. The major league seems to be that kind of what's being broadcast live during prime time, and what the revelations we're seeing coming out. Was any of your stuff used in the live evening broadcast? Like, did that add to their questioning and comments they were making?
Yeah, so some of the material that we captured on January 6th, I believe, was used in the latest hearing just now. As to what they do down the line, I don't know, but. Yes, I mean, anything that I said to them in the interview could be used, and any of the materials that we gave them as well can be used as well.
I must drive you. I'm assuming that the style of interview you did was what we see them sometimes inputting into their their evening primetime shows, which is sitting at a desk, you know, with a bad camera and a terrible microphone. You must have, I was a bit, the production values of the January 6th committee seem so amazing that I'm like, why couldn't they have just got a decent mic? Like, why couldn't they have got a decent mic to sit in front of these people doing their other interviews so we could have heard them a bit more clearly? And as a documentary filmmaker or a technical guy, you must have been like, oh, come on, you can do better than this. This is the US government, for goodness sake.
So, yeah, it's interesting. I actually think that, I mean, I agree in a sense, because a lot of the interviews were probably done, you know, on Zoom, and there's a sort of a limit, I guess, to how much control they have over those, that technology. But in terms of an actual committee hearing, I mean, well, the presentation that they put together is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, they really have done a lot in terms of being able to really, you know, explain all the facts and everything. I mean, in some ways, it's like watching a synopsis.
Totally.
Of sort of like the third episode of the series that I made. So it's, but they do have an advantage in that they had subpoena power, or have subpoena power, and I did not. So they definitely have an advantage on that front. But yeah, I mean, I think they've done a good job.
Look, I'm like a bit of a kid in a candy store at the moment because I want to go everywhere and I'm jumping all over the place, but which is probably more a conversation towards the end of this. But just speaking of that, seeing you brought it up, how hard did you push to get them to talk about them being the Trump family about January 6th? In the documentary, obviously, Trump does, and it seems that everyone else declines to talk about it. I'm only bringing this up now because you talk about subpoena power. I mean, how did you guys push pretty hard to try and get them? Or is it like the understanding is we ask, and if they say no, we leave it alone?
So, I mean, there's a few answers to that question. It's a good question. There's a few answers. I mean, one is that, you know, with long form documentary, and also our series isn't just about January 6th. It's got lots of, sort of narratives all the way through. Obviously, Jan 6th became an incredibly important part and changed everything. I mean, it changed the series, but that's the least important thing. I mean, it changed America, democracy, and really how the world sees America. So it was obviously a significant part. But to me, you know, somebody refusing to answer a question speaks volumes. And the idea that they didn't want to talk about it actually made sense, because in all my interactions with them, with the three children, so we interviewed obviously Ivanka, Eric, and Don Jr., was that they always towed the line when it came to their father. They would never, for them, it was always important to echo what their father was saying. And they may articulate things slightly differently, but ultimately they would never really move away from their father's position. With respect to January 6th, their refusal to answer the question was the first time that I saw them doing something which didn't echo their father's position. So that was very interesting. And my job, I felt, was very much to record the state of mind that these people are in at the time that I'm interviewing them. And so the idea that I would influence or would try to intervene or to do something that was different to their initial position, I felt really wasn't actually really my job, because, you know, like, it's sort of slightly absurd to not ask, you know, to not answer the question about January 6th only a few months after this, you know, cataclysmic event that happened in American history. So to me, it was actually incredibly foolish for them to not want to discuss it. And I felt that that was their answer. So, you know, the events of January 6th were so potentially unimportant to them that they didn't even want to, you know, give it a response, right? Or you could say it was so important they weren't even able to articulate how. Yeah, so there's different ways of looking at it. And I think that it's, I don't think it's cynical to think that the reason they didn't want to talk about it is because they, you know, had at the time a very simplistic view of that event and their responsibility towards it, and they all share some responsibility with respect to those events. I mean, I saw the rhetoric and their behavior all the way through the campaign and after, and they never dissociated themselves from their father, and they sort of therefore, as far as I'm concerned, are somewhat responsible for the events that took place.
Yeah, wow. The whole kind of not offering an opinion or not speaking out words sometimes speak volume. I think the best example I've seen of that to do with January 6th, and look, let me make it clear, your documentary is not a January 6th documentary. It's about the campaign and about the election and all sorts of stuff. But I think it was General Michael Flynn who got asked by Cheney, do you believe in the concept of a peaceful process of power? And he said, I plead the fifth, which for those in New Zealand who don't know means if I answer that, I may incriminate myself. So I choose not to answer it in case the answer may incriminate me of a crime. So he was asked, you know, should we transfer between presidents peacefully? And his answer was, I choose not to answer that in case it incriminates me. So yeah, speaks volume sometimes, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, like, it's the same thing in terms of, and I'm sure you're going to ask this, but I mean, I'll sort of jump the gun here, you know, with respect to like my way of interviewing, you know, President Trump as well, which is that the normal approach is very combative. It's sort of a debate between the person interviewing Trump and Trump himself. And whilst that approach is totally valid and it's fine, you know, based on all the interviews that really exist of Trump, you know, it's very difficult to persuade him on anything, right? Like, he's not really a rational player in the grand scheme of things. So, you know, for me, that was like one part where it's just sort of a waste of time to sort of push back against him, because he doesn't really sort of move away. And, you know, this documentary isn't about me. I mean, I've become part of the story by virtue of the subpoena in January 6th. Yeah. But the doc really barely has me in it at all. I mean, you hear my English accent really sort of three or four times, and then you see me for about 5 seconds at the beginning. So it's really not about me at all. This is a documentary about the three kids and Trump. So therefore, there was never a camera, pointing at me at all, throughout the process. So that's one aspect. The other is that, again, like, I'm there to record history and to record what's going on in this sort of unique moment. And when I interviewed Trump for the first time, this is a guy who had barricaded himself in the White House. It's a month after the election. No one was getting interviews with him whatsoever. So this is really one of the few pieces of material that exists
Wow.
at that point in this time, in this location. And he's still the incumbent. He's still the president of the United States of America with all the apparatus around him. So this is a fascinating insight in what was going on in his mind on December the 5th or whenever it was when we interviewed him. So that to me was very important. And to influence that or to push that or to become part of the story wasn't what I felt was important. People didn't want to hear me. I think it's really important to hear what the president of the United States of America is saying at that time. And what he was saying was, as I said on other interviews, it was batshit crazy.
So I want to jump backwards in a second, but just to for clarity for one question, are you saying the first time, because obviously you were filming and you were involved prior to the election, but the first time you had a sit down with President Trump was a month after he lost. Was it the first time you were one-on-one with him in a room doing an official interview?
Correct.
Wow. What was the reason for that? Because I would have thought you would have tried to attempt to get some stuff in the lead up as well. Was there a was it a was it
Oh,
an
we did.
editing reason or?
Oh no, we did. So the first time he got COVID, so that prevents us from pursuing that. And then the second time was meant to be on Air Force One, and he had to reschedule because he had to take a phone call, which I believe was with the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin. So I felt that was an acceptable reason to delay
Hang
the
on. Oh, you had to, hang on. Sorry, President Trump. No. I'm not going to go behind Putin in the line. He can come after me. No, I get it. Hey, well, that's sheesh. Yeah, look, this is the stuff that blows my brain. Like, I do want to take a little step back because what I want to understand is I do this thing. I've always said to guests, I might start up a second podcast called like 24 hours before or something. And I always love to think about, and like an example is bungee jumping. AJ Hackett is the person who supposedly invented it here in New Zealand. And I always kind of say to him, one of the questions I asked him was, like, the 24 hours before you knew you were going to do that first bungee jump, how are you feeling? I'm always interested in the process up to the moment. So I want to talk to you a little bit about actually getting this documentary and the process you went through to get it. And then also, when you got it, what did that feel like? Was it overwhelming excitement? Was it more fear than anything? What was it? So, how did you go about getting this documentary and getting the access that, like, no one else in the world had gotten?
So I think, there wasn't really a specific moment, right? Like, it evolved over time, which I think is really important in terms of maintaining the access. But ultimately, I've been working on a project about the Middle East for about a year and a half, and I've got some great access to that on that project. And I'd come out to America, and I interviewed somebody who had worked for the Trump family for quite a long time. And then, no, before they went into politics. And then he then joined them in the administration for a couple of years, and he had a role in the White House Middle East file. That was his sort of job there for a couple of years. So that's why I interviewed him for my project about the Middle East. And then while I was there, it was sort of like a, why don't I pitch an idea about making a documentary about the President of the United States and his family? And it was sort of ludicrous in a sense, right? I mean, can I make a doc about President Trump and his kids? And it was obviously, no, the campaign hadn't started. And COVID had just started in Europe, right? It hadn't reached America yet. This is sort of early 2020. And so I sort of brought up the idea, and then it sort of just ended up, the conversation continued. And I think probably one of the things I guess I like to do is probably is perseverance, right? It's just to keep going. And it was never really real that this was going to translate into something tangible, that I would actually be coming out to America. And there were so many things that should have gone wrong. I mean, just even practical things, right? Like, eventually COVID hits and there's lockdowns, and there's now a situation where I can't even get to America because they've closed the borders.
Right.
So I had to get special permits, and there were sort of so many practical things. But and then one of the key things for me, that is always really a contentious conversation to have with anyone you're making a documentary about, is the aspect of editorial control. And I said from the outset, which is normally the conversation you have right at the end, which is that there's no point in doing this unless I have full editorial control, because, you know, I'm just not interested in making sort of puff pieces or propaganda pieces or making things for people where they get a chance to watch it and then drive me crazy about, you know, changing things. I've never done it before and I don't ever intend to do it. So I made that very clear from the outset, and that wasn't an issue. Ultimately, the reason why they agreed to this was, I mean, and this is my own perspective, you know, I don't know for sure, but what I glean from my interactions with them and everything is that there is this, at the beginning, there was this attitude they were absolutely going to win. I mean, this was going to be a repeat of 2016. The polls were all wrong. You know, Don Jr.'s rallying cry at all his events, all his rallies, was "Let's make liberals cry again." The idea being, you know, to sort of go back to the surprise win in 2016, where you see all the Hillary Clinton supporters crying because they were so shocked that she didn't win it. So he's sort of bringing that up all the time. That was his thing. So it was going to be a repeat of 2016. They were going to win again. So the hubris was there. The other was that I was British, and I think that definitely made a difference. Being foreign, I think, you know, not having skin in the game politically, and I think that they felt and feel that a lot of the media in America is very one-sided. And I was pitching to them, look, you know, you guys feel that everyone's against you. You know, I'm here and I want to film, you know, your story and who you are, and you sort of tell me what you want to tell me. I mean, I'm here to do it, and I've got a story I need to tell. So let's you know, you can now prove everyone wrong and show how you've been so unfairly maligned by the media. And so that, I think, was certainly another aspect. And then I joke, you know, maybe it was my British charm, but there is actually, you know, an element of the Trumps, especially Donald Trump, President Trump, who does have this odd affection towards Britain because he's obsessed with the royal family.
Right.
He's very keen on the Queen. And I think there's elements to that. One is that he sees British people as being, I don't know, elegant or, you know, posh or something, which is obviously quite absurd. And secondly, I mean, look at my shirt, right? And then secondly, you know, the other part is that, you know, whether or not he sees himself and his family as some like quasi-dynastic, you know, royal family in a way, perhaps. So, you know, I'm not sure, but this is just all my speculation. But I think and the other thing as well that's really important is that the Trumps find it very difficult to understand why people don't like them. And I think that's very interesting. And it's an ego thing. And Donald Trump has this, obviously, more than anyone, which is that he can't appreciate somebody not liking him unless he doesn't like them.
Yeah.
Then he understands, you know, the reason they don't like me is because I don't like them. The idea of somebody not liking him without sort of his knowledge, he just doesn't really comprehend or appreciate. So I think, you know, to him, how could somebody make a film that makes me look bad because I'm so great?
Yeah.
So, yeah, the idea of there being a potential risk, I think, was really less thought through by him and, you know, Eric and you know, Don Jr. to an extent. But maybe Ivanka was a bit more conscious of it. But other than that, you know, it was just they thought they went for it.
I get the thing about the British thing, because quite often when I'm approaching an international conversation, in the subject line of my email, I'll do something like invitation to a New Zealand conversation, because it's got a little bit of, oh, this is a bit different, you know, and you get people who are like, oh my God, Lord of the Rings and all that kind of stuff. I'm like, yeah. We should talk about that in the interview. You should come on. And so I get kind of using your, shall we call it, geographical privilege?
Yeah, perhaps. Exactly, for sure. And you know, just to come back to your question, because it is actually very interesting, the process of making this, I sort of alluded to it before, was an evolutionary process. It wasn't like I, you know, sort of turn up and, you know, the Trumps are sort of waiting in their motorcades and there we go. I mean, it was very much a process of conversations and interviews. And one of the things that was really interesting that we noticed is that the competition between the three children is immense. And
right.
so, and obviously we've discussed that in the series.
Yeah.
And you know, the father just sort of almost allowed that competition to unfold during their upbringing. And so that competition was actually had a material impact on in the series, in the sense of that I would go and spend some time with Eric on the campaign trail. He would then, and you know, we would show him a little clip, you know, a 20-second clip of him on the stage. And he would then show that on his like WhatsApp group to his siblings. And they'll be like, that's so cool. We want that. And
yeah,
then
right.
we would then join them, you know, on the next one. So it sort of like evolved as we were going, which was really interesting. And that's sort of how part of it, how it played out.
Do you think, because there was I think I saw it on CNN, actually, maybe they were interviewing you on CNN. I mean, what you do is you start with CNN, you do Seth Meyers, and then you come and do us. This is the pinnacle, right? Yeah. Those guys have got you warmed up to come and see us. And I think they talked about the aides in the White House and a bunch of the mechanics of the White House didn't really know about this. It was sort of organized through the family. But of course, I guess once Trump's then rubber stamped something, it's rubber stamped no matter what any aide thinks. Do you think in hindsight, and obviously for you, this is amazing, but for them, this was a mistake? Like this has actually not helped their case?
So I don't fully buy the Trump campaign position of sort of not knowing about this, in the sense that there was nothing surreptitious about what we were doing. There was no hidden cameras. And in fact, when we were there, we were so present that, and I'll give you an example, right? My cameraman, our DOP, Michael, was filming all the kids, but this one story, he was on the stage filming Ivanka at a rally. And he's actually on the stage. And CNN phoned Ivanka's campaign manager and said, who the heck is this guy on the stage? He's interrupting our live feed. And so I had to basically try and get to the stage, avoid being tackled by Secret Service to try and get Michael off the stage. And he was just in the moment. So it was a sort of situation where you got CNN yelling, Secret Service were like, what is this guy doing? Getting really close to, you know, Ivanka. And then Michael, who's like, just like not responding to me whilst I'm like doing this, you know, waving my hands in the air, trying to get him off the stage. So we were there. I mean, we had access to what was called the buffer, which is this section right next to the stage where the president speaks. And we even had access behind it as well. And really only like, you know, sort of the really well-known like New York Times or Washington Post photographers can get behind the president, and you get these sort of iconic silhouette type photos of him.
Yeah.
We were doing that with camera, which is really unique. And you know, as you've seen in the series, some amazing access where he is sort of coming out the plane and he has the beasts, you know, sort of driving parallel while he's walking, sort of like Kim Jong-un like. And you know, we got so close to him that at one point we were closer to him, or Michael was closer to him than Secret Service were. So like, there's just no way in my mind that people, and this is during the campaign.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like the campaign had to have known that.
But do you think it's more that they're saying this didn't come through us, i.e. we didn't vet it, we didn't authorize it, as opposed to we had no idea? Like, I more read that as they kind of went, you know, if we had been involved in organizing this, maybe it would have felt a bit different. That's what I got from them saying that.
I mean, yeah, perhaps. I mean, I think that, you know, maybe they don't. No, I mean, well, when they said it, I don't know. I don't think the series was even out yet, so they were sort of assuming that it was bad.
Right.
But, yeah, they need to watch it first and then see it. But look, I think yes, I understand like the political sort of position that they would have, which is like there's a guy sort of directing and people running around with cameras during the campaign and the White House and also afterwards, like. Okay, that's a bit odd, but sure. I mean, but also, like, we got into the White House on multiple occasions. That's probably the most secure building in the world.
Right.
So again, it's like, if they were really concerned, surely they would have said something at the time.
So but, why yeah. are they saying it? Are they saying it because they're trying to do, because this is a bad look for the president, and they're trying to go, nothing to do with us? We didn't, nothing to do with us? Why are they, why is this out sure. there?
Yeah, I would imagine that's probably the reason I would say, yeah, I think so.
I think in that same interview on CNN, they talked about you spending 11 hours of interviews. So that's with the primary characters, sit-down interviews. How long did you actually spend with, like, the overall project? Like, were you there all day, every day filming? Were you embedded with them like a, you know, like a war journalist would be with a troop? Did you catch and see everything, and that 11 hours was just the interviews? Or was it just if and when you could get and were allowed access, you got access here and there?
Yeah, so there's about sort of, I would say about 11-ish hours or so of interview material.
Yeah.
But like there's over 100 hours worth of just all the other material that we captured over the course of the project. And you know, a lot of that is just, I don't know, like, you know, actuality and you know, sort of B-roll shots and, you know, and interactions with audiences and things, and people that went and participants and whatnot, as well as these behind the scene moments with the family as well. So there was like sort of a myriad of different you know, bits of footage that we captured all the way through the project. But look, we were not sort of the camera crew that was in the toilets with them, or you know, what sort of watching them I don't know, on the phone. Well, the best example is we did not capture Donald Trump in the Secret Service, you know, van allegedly attacking his agent, nor do we have him ripping tablecloths or, you know, throwing plates and ketchup across the walls of the White House. But we do get, I think, a really fascinating insight into the lives and the interactions of his three eldest kids, and also these sort of very candid moments every now and then from all of them, including the father as well. So I think it is a very interesting portrait and portrayal of his family.
You didn't see any of that stuff, as you said, that we heard about in the January 6th committee. But if you were embedded, you might have heard the buzz. I mean, like, did you hear any of that kind of stuff? Like, for example, the day of the grabbing of the steering wheel allegation, was there any buzz around? Were you, because you were on the stage that day, weren't you? You guys, the cameras were on the stage. Was there any buzz back in the White House? Did you hear anything going around, or do they lock down their gossip because it's Secret Service pretty damn quickly?
So, I mean, I was in the White House about 6 days after January 6th when we interviewed Mike Pence. And there was an unquestionable, you know, feeling of, like, you know, negativity and depression. It was a very dark sort of feeling amongst all the people that I was interacting with from the moment we got in. And, you know, we were in, so, you know, the White House is, obviously you've got the White House, it's a complex, and there's also a building there called the OEOB, which is where the Vice President's ceremonial office is, and it's a beautiful room. And in that building that this office is in, we saw like all sorts of desks and things that were upended, and because they were obviously moving out for the new administration,
right?
But when you sort of take the desks upside down and the chairs and thrown into the corridors and the sort of papers and things all over the place, and couple that with what's going on that day, there was a resolution to pass the 25th Amendment, and pressure was being put on, you know, Mike Pence on that day, and just the overall feeling of the staff that was there. I mean, you couldn't make it up. It was the most extraordinary day that I, every single day of this project was extraordinary in its own right. And, you know, coming back to that earlier question, how it sort of evolved, you know, it was like every day we were capturing history and something was happening. I mean, and the coincidences a lot of the time were also, you know, certainly not lost. So for instance, the first time I interviewed Jared Kushner, that was the evening that Trump tweeted that he had COVID. So, you know, we were there with all the people that his closest aides. So we all had to get tested because, you know, we could have got it, right? So, like, there were just so many moments of just, you know, insane things that were going on in America that we were privy to be around at various, you know, all the way through the project. So, you know, January 12th was the day, which, I mean, obviously I'll never forget any of this, but there was just this feeling of total, like shock and people being so upset, because there were a lot of people that worked the White House that didn't necessarily, well, they certainly didn't subscribe to Trump's insanity after the election, but they did subscribe to his policies and his positions and whatnot, and they worked there for the 4 years, and they were so upset that their work would be complete. They knew that Trump's legacy would be entirely January 6th and the narrative of the stolen election, and they were obviously very upset about that as well. Like, will they be able to get jobs with some of the things that were coming out of there?
I think that's a really interesting point. And I think from a political point of view, I've heard a lot of commentators who kind of have their heads screwed on correctly and not to, because people, for example, think that Liz Cheney all of a sudden is the savior of the Democrats. I mean, Liz Cheney has voted with Trump all the way through. So basically, bar his morality issues, she's been on board with his voting record and passing his legislations all the way through. And now she's come up against some, obviously for the right reason, some issues, but she's not the savior and the saint to the left that many are portraying her as. And it actually this leads me into another question I wanted to ask you about that. And I'll bring up an image. These are some of the people that quit after January 6th. Yeah. Some of the people who handed their notice in, and some of them are like Betsy DeVos and stuff. It feels a bit non-consequential to me because, for those of us who identify as being on the left, she's a horrible person anyway, and some pretty nasty things. I won't ask you to comment on that. But people like Sarah Matthews, when I was watching your documentary, right, and I watched all the way through what had been happening, when I watched through the lies and stuff coming in after the election immediately, and then it was the January 6th moment that caused Sarah Matthews, who's a deputy White House press secretary, right? So she's there every day in that space. That was the moment that caused her to hand her resignation in. I went, really? Meaning there, for a quote unquote normal human being, to me, after watching your documentary, I'm like, but what about after that moment? Why didn't you separate yourself after that moment? It was like it had to get to the worst of the worst of the worst of the worst for some of these people to find a spine where either their job or their political ideology now needed to come to the forefront over the actions of Donald Trump. But I guess what I'm saying is the actions all the way leading up to January 6th, I think for most decent people, should have caused them to run a mile. And I just thought that as I was watching your documentary.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really speak to their motivations and their reasons. The only thing I can say is that, and one of the things that a lot of these people who worked in the administration did say during these hearings was, if I leave, who's going to take over? And there was sort of this, I think, feeling by a lot of the people there, which was, I need to stay to prevent any more insanity taking place, perhaps. Because, who would fill these roles if I leave now? Right. It is an argument that people have put forward. But sure, I mean, for me, and I'll never forget this, and I'm saying, you mentioned Seth Meyers, and we sort of laugh at this, but it's true. I mean, after having interviewed Trump the first time in the White House, I was so taken aback. I was so shocked by his position and by the fervor and the belief in his insanity and the realization. I mean, look, the guy with the nuclear football was outside, was behind me during this interview, right? Like, so this is the most powerful man in the world who is literally advocating to destroy democracy.
Yeah.
And I was so shocked by that that I sort of had to hold myself on the wall, and then I said, let's not think about this now, let's just wait till I get back to the hotel. It was like, this is not going to go well, was my feeling. This is very, very dangerous. And so I think that there were plenty of people at the White House who may have felt that and felt that they needed to stay to try and, see if there's anything they could do to persuade or to push back against some of the more dangerous things that could have been discussed. I don't know if we know, were discussed at the White House during this period of time.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like you hear about the mole that wrote for, I think it was the Washington Post or one of those, and the mole that was there partway through saying, we're here, we're holding the line. And really, I mean, it sounds like it's a nice story, but you could obviously equally push back against that story that says, well, that means therefore when it got the most important to have decent people there, like after the six, that's when you decided to cut out. Like, so, I mean, whatever, they can push that barrow, but I don't know. I just think like,
I hear what you're saying. I mean,
if that was the tipping point.
Yeah.
But none of us know. None of us know.
Yeah, exactly.
You're talking about editing and you're talking about rights, like any of the rights to having full editorial, being able to change, not allowing the Trumps to change anything. There was a moment quite early on in the documentary, and I think there was like a phone bank system going on where they were phoning around looking for money and, you know, saying support Donald Trump, where, you know, you got one of the sons to go, could you turn that off for a sec? And they walk away and they have hushed tones between them. I think I saw that a couple of times in the documentary. How do you handle that as a documentary filmmaker? Because that's my perspective is something, this is something good. Because they don't want us there. So when they kind of say, well, look, we want our privacy right now, we don't want you to be involved. And when they walk away from it, I mean, I'm assuming they're mic'd up as opposed to being a boom mic. How do you handle those situations? Because they're actually taking some editorial control away from you by kind of shooing you away because they've got secret things to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, when I say editorial control, I mean insofar as the crafting and the inclusion or not inclusion of material, you know, what's been captured, and also not asking for anyone to, not asking any contributors for their opinion on things or to show them stuff before it's finished.
In the edit suite.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But ultimately, if I, you know, right now, I have no editorial control of what I'm saying, you know, to you, Pat, right? Like, I'm going to say something.
This is going to look terrible for you. This is going to be a terrible, terrible situation.
But the truth is that, you know, we all have the ability just to stand up and leave, right?
So
there's always that when you are working with anyone, for any documentary, with any contributor, and you're filming, there's always that moment where they could just say, do you know what, I've changed my mind. You know, I don't want to do this anymore. And so, you know, you have to work around that. And you're right. It only happened twice. The first time they didn't say to them, what actually happened is that they walk away, and what they're actually discussing is telling us to leave. So it wasn't actually that interesting. It was, and to be honest, what we had already captured there was in retrospect, sort of quite astonishing that we were allowed in there at all. Mm. And let's just say that there may be some, you know, things from that day that might come out down the line that right. might be of interest.
Okay.
But then the other occasion is when Eric says, can you shut that off for a second? I actually really love those moments because those moments are just like, what is he actually doing and what's actually happening there and what's going on? And 99% of the time it's really benign and nothing is going on. And, you know, cameras might turn off, but not, you know, other things might not turn off. So, I mean, I think it's always the sort of occupational hazard, right? Like at the end of the day, we are there as their guest for all intents and purposes, right? Like as in, yes, they've agreed to let us film, but people can change their minds. And, you know, we just have to work with it and do what we can. And for me, long form documentary is all about maintaining access, maintaining relationships and trying to, you know, try. And we were lucky because I can imagine for some projects, there's really that fine line between, well, you're really not letting me get any access, so access do I really have? For us, like I said, over the course of spending a significant amount of time with them, it was really on only two occasions, and where they and they were always sort of towards the end of the occasion anyway, when they said, you know, enough's enough. But that obviously never happened during, you know, interviews or anything like that. So there are elements of control that contributors always have.
I'd like to ask you some questions now that have come specifically from the documentary. And it's one of the reasons I wanted to know how embedded you were and how much of the time you were kind of, not to say that you've got information that's not on the documentary, but kind of maybe for the vibe around that, what you heard, what you saw that maybe wasn't filmed or wasn't in there as well. So like specifically, you said you were there on the day that Trump was announced that he had COVID. Most are saying, media commentators have said at the time that it was actually really, really serious for him. Obviously, the Trump family and Trump himself trying to make it like it's no big deal, it was just precautions. What was the vibe on the inside? Was it super serious? Was he close to like going under pretty seriously? What was your understanding?
Well, I mean, in episode two, Ivanka and Trump actually reveal, which is actually really interesting, how sick he really was. And I think that was a really fascinating moment because they had been maintaining this position when they were in office, that he was okay and it was all precautions. Yeah. And they reveal in the series that that wasn't true at all. And Ivanka, really, you can see the concern that she has when she's sort of reliving that moment. And Trump himself, his surprise having actually been told that he got it, which was ironic because he had made no efforts whatsoever to try and avoid getting it. and also his attitude towards what he felt when he actually was told that he got it. You know, his feeling was it was scary because he knew people who had died.
Yeah.
He starts saying that he knew four or five people that died, which was remarkable because he was the president of the United States where tens of thousands of people died. And that wasn't what he brought up. What he brought up were the three, four, five friends of his that he says, people, associates or people that he knew, was what made him nervous about having got COVID. So that as well was very unique. And it really shows the kind of character that Trump is, which is that he really is only persuaded by anecdotes and by things that he can appreciate and understand. The idea that tens of thousands of people are dying when he is in charge is something that doesn't affect him when he actually gets told that he has COVID. What affects him is the few people he knows who got sick and didn't make it. So that was quite interesting. But sure, I mean, when I was there on that day, he tweeted it in the evening. So we had left already. And it's actually quite funny because I went to sleep really early that night. And when I woke up early in the morning, and I thought somebody had died because my phone had like hundreds of messages and missed calls. And I was like, what is going on? And we were having the most surreal conversations ever. I mean, literally, like having conversations about like the movie I was making and the main character who we hadn't yet interviewed potentially could die. And
yeah,
that person
wow.
was the president of the United States. Like, so I'm talking about the president of the United States in a way where like there's sort of more of a connection than, you know, to him and like to the people around him than, you know, than anyone else. And like being concerned from the point of view of my movie rather than like from the point of view of like the geopolitical events yeah. that could take place, the president dies. It was just such a weird situation that was going on all the way through.
How has this documentary gone down, especially in MAGA world? Like, have you come under any kind of scrutiny, or, you know, we see sometimes the MAGA world, you know, being fairly violent or at least fairly confrontational. Have you had any pushback on like the content of it from the Trump loyalists?
So it's really fascinating, the reaction. And I think that we've done, or at least what I felt the result or the reaction would be, has played out almost exactly the way I thought, which is that, you know, because this is not a hatchet job, right? This is not a job where we're sort of trying to beat people over the head to make them think something. You know, it clearly shows, in my mind, I hope it clearly shows the trajectory of how, you know, Trump and his kids, their rhetoric and their belligerence on the campaign led to the events of January 6th. But it also includes, I think, a really interesting insight into the dynamics in the family. And you get to see who these people are. And I don't think it necessarily surprises, right? It vindicates yeah. positions,
yeah,
which
yeah.
I think is really, really cool. So what we've seen are people on the, you know, the extreme Trumpers, the ones that love Trump, they have called me, you know, I know everything from like snowflake, liberal, you know, mainstream media. And there's obviously been, you know, unfortunate threats and things from that world. So they hate it. And then what's amazing is that on the complete other end of the spectrum, I have people who despise Trump, who say it's a pro-Trump propaganda film,
so,
which I find is so interesting. And I'd love both those two sides to sort of talk because like they don't work together, right? Like as in, I'm a person that hates Trump, let's say, And I see this film as propaganda. So that, you know, and I, so therefore I hate Trump. This film just, it, you know, shows how, you know, Trump's great. Therefore I hate the film. Then you've got another person who watches exactly the same film and sees their hero being trounced and sees that this is the worst film ever because it's anti-Trump, it's liberal, it's badly cut, it's, you know, it's biased. Like, what do they say to each other? Like, they both dislike the series, but for the complete opposite reasons, which I think is fascinating. And to me, it shows that it is a series which I think really does something which I think is quite unique, is it toes this line in a way which I think is not really done in America, because obviously the politics here is so polarizing and the way the media is all sort of works in this country. So I think that was very unique. But on the whole, I mean, the Trump supporters have not been the most complimentary and are quite threatening and have led me to need security, etc. But yeah, it is what it is, unfortunately.
There was this, a particular moment in the documentary when you were talking to Trump about January 6th, and he did talk about it. And he basically smashed any of the conspiracy theories out there that it's Antifa or it's, you know, an inside job or whatever, when he acknowledges that the people breaking into the Capitol building were his supporters. And I wonder how that has gone under the radar. So, well, it feels, I could be wrong, but it feels like that's gone under the radar, because I was watching, you know, there's that lovely Scottish guy on CNN who goes around doing vox pops with people. And he was at a Trump rally over the weekend, and they're all like, no, it's all fake, it's all fake, it's all Antifa, it's all Black Lives Matter, it's fake. But then Trump in your documentary confirms that the people in the Capitol were his people. And I'm amazed that it wasn't a headline for you know, I mean, 24-hour news cycle, for at least three or four of those news cycles, but it seems to have a little bit gone under the radar.
Yeah, I agree. And I've actually said this a lot. I think that was an incredibly important and fascinating moment, because not only does he do what you just said, Pat, in terms of making, you know, drawing a direct link to his supporters going in to the Capitol,
yeah,
he calls them smart. Yeah. And he also says that the reason they went in was because they believe that their election was stolen. Well, the only reason they believe that their election was stolen was because he had told
him.
That,
yeah.
Right? So he is literally admitting that the reason why people went into the Capitol is A, because they believe the election was stolen, and B, because they're smart, you know, and C, they are his supporters. So that's the clear admission, right, of his culpability, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the idea that he would, you know, if you, like, he had spent weeks after the election telling everyone that the election was stolen and that Mike Pence needs to come through. Now, after all the various things that they tried to do didn't work, all their court cases were all dismissed, the Supreme Court refused to hear the case. The last thing he had was this absurd idea that intervening on the 6th of January, where they have this ceremonial process of counting the Electoral College votes, intervening in that process would allow him to remain in office, right? And the only person he felt that could do that was the vice president. And he was obviously putting a lot of pressure on him. And we were at a rally the day before, or it was two days before, in Georgia, where he was really pushing that he hopes Mike Pence comes through. And no, he does the usual mafia boss type thing where it's like, you know, and if he doesn't, then we won't like him very much.
He's going to go sleeping with the fishes.
Right, like exactly. Yeah, it's like the typical Trump thing, like, you know, we won't like him very much, nod, nod, wink, wink, right?
Yeah.
And then on the day of January 6th, I mean, he literally says the words, like, we need to fight like hell, we need to get back our country. Yeah, we're going to march down Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol. So he says all of this. So it's very clear as to why, you know, those people marched up Pennsylvania Avenue. It's very clear why they all came, because he had tweeted to everyone, come, you know, to this massive rally at the Ellipse. And then in that interview, he clearly says the reason why they went in was because they felt the election was stolen and they're smart. So to me, that, you know, you're sort of bang to rights at that point. right?
Yeah, it's a bizarre thing. Do you think Trump's smart? I mean, we know that he's got a very big brain, but I know IQ doesn't always necessitate, you know, smartness in general. But is he a smart dude, or is he? Some people think he's basically a clown that's fallen into this thing, and because of his bravado, he pushes through. Other people think he's sort of calculating and exacting, and he knows exactly what he's doing when he talks about them. They're sending us their rapists and that kind of stuff. He's calculated. Where do you think he sits on that scale?
No, I was taken aback by how, I mean, dim-witted he is. I mean, you know, he is just one of the most unusual people I've come across. He has, you know, various things. You know, he's charming to a degree, but it's completely overpowered by his narcissism and by his obsession with anything that he owns or touches or is involved with is the best in the world. And, you know, it's sort of like a caricature, you know, he's like a caricature of himself in respect. I mean, you know, there's the story in Mar-a-Lago where he comes in to the room that we're setting up in. And the room is a very beautiful room, actually. I mean, Mar-a-Lago is stunning. And he comes in and I go, "Hello, Mr. President." And, you know, you see this in the series. And he goes, he ignores me and he just says, "Look at this floor. Isn't this the most beautiful floor in the world?" And I was just like, of all the things to talk about in that room, the floor was the last thing that was impressive. I mean, it was actually really quite scuffed and not at all nice at all. And then he sits down and whilst all the cameras and things are being moved around, you know, you do sort of the small talks. Like, "Mr. President, last time we saw each other was a few months ago at the White House." And he immediately just says, straight away, he says, "Sure, but this is much more beautiful than the White House, right?" You know, this is, and like everything with him is always a one-upmanship. It's always he's better or he owns something that's better than anyone else. And that was very odd. And frankly, you know, the fact that he is unwilling, and I've said this a lot, which is the reason he's unwilling to accept that he lost the election fair and square is because he's just completely lives in another world. You know, he's just detached from any reality. And the reason for that is purely because, you know, Donald Trump cares about one thing, which is Donald Trump and the brand and what Trump is. And the idea of associating defeat with the brand just isn't acceptable to him. So and all the way through his life, whenever he's gone through objective defeats, whether it's a financial crisis, which led in various cases to bankruptcy and restrictions and things, you know, to him where he's lost buildings and whatnot, and where he has failed, he's always pivoted to something else, and he has always blamed other people, and he's never actually accepted that he had done anything or that what actually happened. So that was that. You know, it wasn't sort of unusual, but like here, when you're the president of the United States and you're maintaining this position and eventually causing the tragedy that it caused. Yeah. To be still to this day maintaining this insanity and influencing people, you know, is just horrendous. And so, yeah, I mean, that definitely is the major factor. But no, he's definitely not he's a very odd man.
Cohen, you're about to say it. He's definitely not the sharpest tool in the shed. That was I could hear that in the back of your mirror.
I was going to say the brightest bulb in the chandelier. But yeah,
I knew it was one of those things. Yeah. Were you in and around President Trump when the Landscape Center debacle went on? You know, the Four Seasons landscaping. Yeah. Because you talk about. You haven't said this. Did you say dim-witted? You might have said dim-witted. Yeah. You talk about the situation, you know, that he's not very smart. I wonder though how he reacts when someone arguably dumber than him does something like this, and then rather than cancelling the press conference and sorting it out, decides to hold a press conference outside a fucking landscape center and then try and pretend that's what they're always planning to do. How did Trump react to this?
So I wasn't with him. So it's interesting. After the election, up until the point where we interviewed him, so the election happens, we were at the White House filming his speech that night.
Yep.
And then from that point on, that's when we actually did not have any interactions with the family for about a period of about 4 weeks, and then the access literally regained itself with the invitation to interview Trump at the White House on the 5th, or I think it was 4th of December. So, and then of all the things that, and obviously that took place, I think, prior to that. So, you know, so of all the things that were sort of going on at the time, and I've now got my chance to, you know, speak directly to the president. Yeah. In the White House, I don't want to bring up the debacle of the landscape of the Four Seasons, but yeah, I mean, it just shows you sort of what a sort of clown shop they were running. I mean, it was just absolutely absurd, wasn't it?
I mean, I listen to people like Giuliani, and I say this quite a lot. I love talking to Americans. It's not nothing against Americans, but you know, there's this whole, and I've written in a quote from. That was shown in your documentary from a CNN clip or a Fox News clip about the greatest democracy on earth, you know, Rudy Giuliani. And I always say to American guests who I have come on, especially if they're political, like political animals, I'm like, what's your metric for that? Like, how do you measure that? Because I look from the outside in and I don't see what you see. You're British, right? I mean, we're in the Commonwealth. We're kind of cousins on some level. How does your vibe being in this country, kind of at the seat of power, at the seat of democracy, and then trying to step outside of it and think of people describing what you've documented and what they say is the greatest democracy on earth?
I mean, it's an interesting one, right? I mean, on the one hand, they've only ever had 45 guys in charge, right? You know, since the country's been around, and there was this understanding, right, all the way through, that when you lose the election, you're going to hand over power in a decent and correct manner, and there aren't that many laws really that determine exactly what happens in that odd period between November, when the election takes place, and January, when the new president comes in. And so there's this sort of understanding that there would be, the convention of, you know, understanding the fundamentals of democracy, which is respecting what the people say, the vote, and not trying to bring the whole system down.
Yeah.
And after, you know, 44 people, here's a guy that was willing to at least attempt to try and do that. The fact that it's still standing, I think, is obviously a very good thing. It's admirable, and it shows that the American democracy is robust, despite being chipped away at the core foundations for such a long time. But look, you know, I think, you know, what does it really even mean to be the greatest democracy of all time? I mean, great could be with respect to lots of different things, but I think it's testament to America that they were able to, keep going. And there was an amazing quote that I saw that President Obama wrote a few weeks ago on Twitter, where he said that, I think it was along the lines of, America is still a work in progress. And believing that, I think, is so important to, you know, the essence of what democracy is, right? And that is and having, you know, that mentality is very special. And America's a very young country, and I think it is going through lots of different, you know, things right now. And what Trump did, and I'm just talking with respect to the end of his presidency, really shocked the country and the world in a very significant, visceral way that wasn't just one moment and one day. Yeah, it's going to last for a while. And I think that seeing it and being there during that time, so I realized the gravity of all of this, more than just the horrendous nature of the day itself, the fact that it was tragic and people died and terribly injured, but it, like, constantly chipping away at the foundations. Those foundations won't last.
Yeah.
So what's really important, and I hope the series shows, that, you know, Trump is still around and he is still a powerful force. And, you know, we show the golden statue, right? And that sort of golden statue that was made of Trump. And I think that is, the film has lots of these metaphors and layers and juxtapositions that I hope people understand and appreciate and like and laugh at, but also see as being, we are trying to make a point there. And he isn't gone. And there are people around him who were all for his attempts to undermine democracy. And look, undermining American democracy affects democracies all over the world, right? And so the impact that January 6th had in America can and was felt in New Zealand and in the United Kingdom and France, Europe, Italy, I mean, everywhere, right? So, it's not just an American problem. I think it's a global problem.
What did you learn, if anything, about Melania during the process of your filming?
Very limited.
Yeah. It almost comes back to that: when people don't say words, sometimes it speaks volumes to the truth. So what did you learn about Melania either through what you saw or maybe didn't see?
I really didn't see much of her. I mean, I think on two occasions I had, saw her. No interaction whatsoever. There wasn't even a conversation that was had by anyone from the Trump side to include her at all. And our film was really about, the three eldest kids and the relationship they have with their father and the relationship the father had with them as well. And then the campaign. And to be honest, Melania's role in the campaign was very limited. I mean, she only really came about right towards, the end, if not during what they called the Stop the Steal rallies. I think it was towards the end of the campaign, but either way, very limited role from what I saw.
What do you think, if you had to guess, or if you actually know, it'd be good to know as well, what does Trump think of the doco series? And also, if you're walking through Manhattan and you walked into an Ivanka or an Eric or a Don Jr., boom, you bumped into them, how would that interaction be after this?
Well, I don't know whether or not he's seen it. But if he hasn't seen it, then he can...
He'll love it. If he hasn't seen it, he'll love it. Because it's about him.
Exactly. I mean, absolutely. But also, I was going to say, if he hasn't seen it, in America, you can get it on Discovery Plus and he gets a free week trial. And I also know that Donald Trump is partial to anything to do with sharks. And Trump is obsessed with sharks.
Shark
Discovery
week.
Plus, it has... Exactly. So... he gets to watch Shark Week literally and perhaps Shark Week metaphorically as well.
So. What happens if you actually, without meaning to, bumped into any of the main features in this documentary? How are they going to react to you, do you think?
Look, I think that what I made is a very fair portrayal of events that took place during the campaign all the way up to January 6th. I also think it's a very fair portrayal of their lives and their characters. And so I hope they would agree. But I think in the context of January 6th and all the various things that have come about from that there's an assumption that's been made. But I look forward to seeing or hearing their views on the film at some point down the line.
Last question. Before I sign off, what was left, if anything, on the editing floor for time constraints? Like some filmmakers hate director's cuts. Other people love them because they get to include everything that they couldn't. Was there anything we missed out on that you want to tell us about now? Because just not even through an editorial decision of content, but you just couldn't quite put it in?
Well, there was plenty of stuff that didn't make it in. But I'll just say that there may be... an opportunity for people to see some of that material down the line.
Goodness me. That's a tease and a half. I think that's what that's called. A tease and a half. I love your Twitter feed. And I'm interested as well as a documentary filmmaker. How do I ask this question? It's like you've come out after it, this documentary film, you called him batshit crazy. I can't imagine too many documentary filmmakers would sort of come out after their subject has been documented and then kind of, and I'm not saying speak ill of them in a bad way, but you've offered some pretty strong opinions. And I mean, here's a perfect example. I love this. It's hilariously fantastic. the day that the thing dropped on Discovery Plus, your tweet was "Orange, you glad it's premiere day, unprecedented," and it's based on what Trump said in that room.
Can we get the orange out, please? Is that possible? It's very orangey. I don't know why that is.
I just think, I mean, to me, that just speaks of absolutely no self-awareness that he would use that word in that context and not kind of get how the rest of the world is going to laugh at him. But yeah, what about your kind of your attitude towards the Trumps or towards Donald Trump at the moment, being fairly public as well, post-documentary?
I mean, do you not think he's batshit crazy?
Oh, completely, but I haven't just spent, you know, a year or 6 months or whatever with him kind of, and he's not my subject matter. I just wonder about that idea of, I don't know, is it a, I love what you're writing and I agree with everything you're saying, but I wonder about, like, the next documentary you make, you know, will that person go, you know, what are they going to say about me after the documentary? I'm wondering how that kind of works in your head.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that I don't think that Trump thinks he's batshit crazy. So if I make another film about somebody, you know, they probably don't think that they are batshit crazy. Look,
right.
My take here is that, you know, you could make a documentary about someone. Look, it's a very unusual series in the sense that our protagonists are in certain respects also, you know, like we almost have to, you know, prove them wrong on various occasions, right? Because, you know, there isn't a world in which ever that Ivanka Trump, Don Jr. or Eric is going to say a bad word about their father, right?
Yeah.
But then, so you need to sort of, we needed to weave in this aspect of the film that showed that what they were saying wasn't really 100% accurate all the time. So, for example, you know, they'll say, like, my dad was always present, and then we'd contrast that with a photo of, sure, dad is there at the baseball game, but he's on the phone and Ivanka is looking entirely miserable that her dad isn't actually interacting.
But actually, but on that point, I thought about that because Ivanka said, you know, he's not the kind of guy to come to my sports games. But he's a great dad. I went, no, that's not a great dad. That's an asshole. You know, it's like, actually you make the wealthiest, busiest people in the world make time for their kids, even if it's once or twice a year to go see their sports game. But she bluntly says, he never attended any of my stuff that other parents would do. And then kind of flip it away like, but that's fine. So,
yeah, and that's very interesting, very revealing, for sure. And I completely agree with that. But, like, I guess my point is that, you know, this is a guy who, you know, like, ended up believing in this absurdity that he created, i.e., you know, that the election was stolen. Everyone that's anyone in his own administration is telling him that he's wrong. He then incites an angry crowd he had riled up to storm the American parliament whilst they're chanting that they want to assassinate his own vice president. So, like, I don't think that in response to any question that somebody asked me, having actually met him and heard him say these things, that I could say anything like, oh, well, an audience needs to come to their own conclusion as to his culpability. Like, you know, I'm not really pontificating over too much over sort of, you know, him as a father. You know, we let, as you just did, Pat, you know, you can interpret his father-like character, you know, yourself. We have amazing moments where he is witnessing on the iPad his kids watching, you know, he's watching his own kids' campaign. And he reacts in a way where some people can say that's a reaction of envy towards his own kids, and some people can see that and see it as a reaction of pride. What I found interesting was in that moment, you see a reaction on Trump's face that you've never seen before.
Right.
Because no one's ever thrust an iPad at him and made him look at his own kids. But what was very telling and revealing was that moment where he says, look, my kids all have their own base, but really it's part of my base.
Saw that. It was true as well. So their fame is my fame, and that means I'm more famous.
Sure, which is a really unusual thing for a father to say about their kids. But I say the word unusual. I don't say, you know, I think it's worth noting, right?
Yeah.
But with respect to you know, the January 6th and the chaos that he caused, to me, you know, batshit crazy is probably the, yeah, the starting point of where you go.
Not that this is a question, but it's just based on purely the way that this has been written up on our New Zealand channel here, TV3. It says season one. Is this a one-off three-part? Other than obviously the editor's cut, which we're going to possibly see in the select committee, is there any more coming out of this footage? Is there a follow-up to this, or is it just a three-part standalone documentary series?
We'll see what happens next.
Oh, little teaser. Another little teaser. That's good. We'll have to get you back on, Alex. Hey, thanks for joining us today, Matt. I've been so excited. Thanks to Liz for setting this up ever since we got a yes. I mean, I understand that you haven't spoken to, is it any other New Zealand media yet at any point?
No, I don't think so. No.
So we can officially call this a New Zealand exclusive?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's also, I think, the longest interview I've done as well, so... Yeah,
I hope that's okay. That's kind of how we roll. We just roll and chat. To be honest, I had another half dozen questions, but I'm in control of editing here. I have complete editorial control, and I've chosen to push them to the side. So it's an amazing documentary. Obviously we're on the internet, so anyone around the world can possibly see this. Whatever country it's in, you should check it out. Trump Unprecedented. Congratulations. I look forward to finding out what happens next, because actually one other thing is, because through this I've also discovered what you have done previously, and I haven't seen this yet. Oopsie, I pushed the wrong button there. I haven't seen this yet, but I'm incredibly excited to check out Keep Quiet, you know, and for people who are listening or who don't know, I didn't know until I met you, an anti-Semitic far-right politician's astonishing transformation after finding out he is Jewish. Another documentary. So I've already put that in my must-see list. So discovering you through this has caused me to discover other things you have done, which I'm very excited about. And I'm excited to see what comes next, Alex. So thank you for joining us here on the Department of Conversation.
Pleasure. Really lovely chatting with you, Brett.